podcast is from the Kentucky Women Writers Conference, made possible by the University of Kentucky in Lexington. This reading features new work by Kelly Link and Karen Joy Fowler. Kelly Link's fiction has been compared to Kafka and Borges, and here she reads Two Houses from the anthology Shadow Show in celebration of Ray Bradbury. The story is set on a rocket ship headed to Mars. Karen Joy Fowler is the author of the Jane Austen Book Club and five previous novels. Here she reads from We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves, a new novel forthcoming in 2013. Longtime friends, the authors introduce each other, beginning with Fowler, who introduces Link.
It is my great privilege to introduce Kelly Link to you this morning. My friend, the great writer Kim Stanley Robinson, was once talking to me about books that you like and writing that you like and stories that you like, and he put them into two categories. He said there was writing that where somebody was doing something that maybe was not that different from what you yourself did, but they were just doing it really, really well, and so there was a great deal of pleasure in admiring somebody who was so skillful at something that you were yourself trying to become skillful at. But the second kind, he said, is a kind of writing where you just, you can't imagine how anybody wrote that, you know, how that happened. It's not something that you feel that you can imitate yourself, because it comes from a place that that you don't recognize. And it's that second kind of writing that I think is the most exciting, and for me, Kelly Link represents that second kind of writing, that there's just something about the way she thinks, about the way she sees the world, about the way she describes the world, that is just a continual surprise as you read her work, and a continual delight, and with luck, changes some that you too can begin to see the world in smart and funny and delightful ways, at least for as long as the story lasts, and maybe even beyond. So I first met Kelly many years ago when I was teaching at the Clarion Writing Workshop, which is a science fiction workshop, and she came to take it as a student. She brought two stories in. During that, it's a six-week workshop. One of them was The Specialist's Hat, and one of them was Travels with the Snow Queen, both of which I thought were just astonishing stories then. I still think they're astonishing stories. They remain among my favorites, but her recent work is, as I said, a continual surprise and delight. And one of the great pleasures of my career has been watching people find Kelly Link and love her work the way that I love her work, and the way that you love her work or will soon. Kelly.
I feel so much smarter and so much of a better writer than I did before you started speaking. So thank you. I'm going to read part of a story which was recently published in an anthology of stories that was written in honor of Ray Bradbury. The anthology is called Live Forever, and this is a story called Two Houses, which is it's a club narrative. It's a story where you have a bunch of people who are telling stories to each other, and so this is one of the stories. And I don't know if it adds anything or not, but the people who are telling stories to each other are on a rocket going somewhere else. I have a story, Sissy said. Not really a ghost story. I'm not sure what it was. It was the story of a man I dated for a few months. I don't think I've told any of you about him. This was during the period when they weren't building new ships, remember? They kept sending us out to do fundraising. I did a good enough job that they sent me over to meet a consortium of investors and big shots in London. I met all sorts of guys, but the only one I clicked with was this one dude, Liam. Okay, here's where it gets complicated for a bit. Liam's mother was English. She came from this old family, lots of money and not a lot of supervision, and by the time she was a teenager, she was a total wreck, into booze, hard drugs, recreational Satanism, you name it.
got kicked out of school after school after school, and after that, she got kicked out of all the best rehab programs, too. In the end, her family kicked her out, gave her money to go away. She ended up in prison for a couple of years, had a baby. That was Liam, bounced around Europe for a while. Then, when Liam was about 7 or 8, she found God and got herself cleaned up. By this point, her father and mother were both dead, one of the super flus. Her brother had inherited everything. She went back to the ancestral pile and tried to make things good with her brother. So her brother was kind of a jerk, and let me emphasize once again, this was a rich family like you have no idea. The mother and the father and the brother were into collecting art, contemporary stuff, video installations, performance art, stuff that was really far out. They commissioned this one artist, an American, to come and do a site-specific installation. It was supposed to be a commentary on the transatlantic exchange, the post-colonial relationship between England and the U.S., something like that. And what he did was he bought a ranch house out in a suburb in Arizona, the same state, by the way, where you can still go and see the original London Bridge. This artist bought the suburban ranch circa 1980, and the furniture in it and everything else, down to the rolls of toilet paper and the cans of soup in the cupboards. And he had the house dismantled with all of the pieces numbered and plenty of photographs and video so he would know exactly where everything went. And it all got shipped over to England, and then he built it all over again on the family's estate. And simultaneously, he had a second house built right beside it. The second house was an exact replica from the foundation to the pictures on the wall to the cans of soup on the shelves in the kitchen. Anyway, this double installation won some award, got lots of attention. The whole point was that nobody knew which house was which. Then the superflu took out the mom and dad, and a couple of years after that, Liam's mother, the black sheep, came home, and her brother said to her, "I don't want you living in the family house with me, but I'll let you live on the estate. I'll even give you a job with a housekeeping staff. And in exchange, you'll live in my installation," which was apparently something that the artist had really wanted to make part of the project, to find a family to come and live in it. This jerk brother said, "You and my nephew can come and live in my installation. I'll even let you pick which house." Liam's mother went away and talked to God about it. Then she came back and moved into one of the houses. I don't know which one. "Look, what I was interested in at the time was Liam. I know why he liked me. Here I was, this girl with an American passport, dreadlocks, and cowboy boots, talking about how I was going to go get in a rocket and go up into space just as soon as I could. What man doesn't like a girl who doesn't plan to stick around? What I don't know is why I liked him so much. The thing is, he wasn't really a good-looking guy. He had a nice round English butt. His hair wasn't terrible. But there was something about him you just knew he was going to get you into trouble, the good kind of trouble. When I met him, his mother was dead. His uncle was dead, too. They weren't a lucky family. They had money instead of luck. The brother had never married, and he'd left Liam everything. We went out for dinner. We gave each other all the right kind of signals, and then we fooled around some, and he said he wanted to take me up to his country house for the weekend. It sounded like fun. I was picturing one of those little thatch cottages you see in detective series, but it was a big old pile, except with video screens in the corner showing mice eating each other and little kids eating cereal. Nice, right? He said we were going to go for a walk around the estate. We walked out about a mile through this typical south of England landscape, and then suddenly we're approaching this weather-beaten, rotting stucco house that looked like every ranch house I'd ever seen in a depopulated neighborhood in the Southwest, y'all. This house was all by itself on a green English hill. It looked wrong. Maybe it had looked better before the other one had burned down, or at least more intentionally weird the way an art installation should. But anyway, yeah, the other house had burned down. So there we are in front of this horrible house, and Liam picked me up and carried me across the threshold like we were newlyweds. He dropped me on a rotting tan couch and said, "I was hoping you would spend the night with me." I said, "You mean back at your place?" He said, "I mean here." I said to him, "You're going to have to explain." And so he did, and now we're back at the part where Liam and his mother moved into the installation. You know, I've never told this story before. The rest of it, I'm not even sure I know how to tell it. Liam's mother picked a house, and they moved in. Liam's just this little kid, a bit abnormal because of how they'd been living, and there are all these weird rules, like they aren't allowed to eat any of the food in the shelves in the kitchen because that's part of the installation. Instead, the mother has a mini fridge in the closet in her bedroom. Oh, and there are clothes in the closets in the bedrooms, and there's a TV, but it's an old one. And the installation artist set it up so it only plays shows that were current in the early 90s in the U.S., which was the last time the house was occupied. And there are weird stains on the carpets in some of the rooms, big brown stains. But Liam doesn't care so much about that. He gets to pick his own bedroom, which seems to be set up for a boy maybe a year or two older than Liam is. There's a model train set on the floor, which Liam can play with as long as he's careful. And there are comic books, old ones, that Liam hasn't read before. There are cowboys on the sheets. There's a big stain here in the corner under the window. And he's allowed to go into the other bedrooms as long as he doesn't mess anything up. There's a pink bedroom with twin beds, lots of girls' clothes, and a stain in the closet. There's a room for an older boy, too, and with posters of actresses that Liam doesn't recognize and a lot of American sports stuff, football, but not the right kind. Liam's mother sleeps in the pink bedroom. You would expect her to take the master bedroom, but she doesn't like the bed. She says it isn't comfortable. Anyway, there's a stain on it that goes right through the duvet, through the sheets. It's as if the stain came up through the mattress. Remember, there are two houses. Liam's mother is responsible for looking after both. She also volunteers at the church down in the village. Liam goes to the village school. For the first 2 weeks, the other boys beat him up, and then they lose interest, and after that, everyone leaves him alone. In the afternoons, he comes back and plays in his two houses. Sometimes he falls asleep in one house watching TV, and when he wakes up, he isn't sure where he is. Sometimes his uncle comes by to invite him to go for a walk on the estate or to go fishing. He likes his uncle. Sometimes they walk up to the manor house and play billiards. His uncle arranges for him to have riding lessons, and that's the best thing. He gets to pretend that he's a cowboy. Maybe that's why he liked me, those boots. Sometimes he plays cops and robbers. He used to know some pretty bad guys back before his mother got religion, and Liam isn't exactly sure which he is yet, a good guy or a bad guy. He has a complicated relationship with his mother. Life is better than it used to be, but religion takes up about the same amount of space as the drugs did. It doesn't leave much room for Liam. Anyway, there are some cop shows on the TV. After a few months, he's seen them all at least once. There's one called CSI, and it's all about fingerprints and murder and blood. And Liam starts to get an idea about the stains in his bedroom and the stain in the master bedroom and the other stains, the one in the living room on the plaid sofa and over behind the lazy boy that you mostly don't notice at first because it's hidden. There's one stain up on the wallpaper in the living room, and after a while it starts to look a lot like a handprint. So Liam starts to wonder if something bad happened in his house and in that other house. He's older now, maybe 10 or 11. He wants to know why there are two houses exactly the same next door to each other. How could there have been a murder, okay, a series of murders, where everything happened exactly the same way twice? He doesn't want to ask his mother because lately when he tries to talk to her, all she does is quote Bible verses at him. He doesn't want to ask his uncle about it either because the older Liam gets, the more he can see that even when his uncle is being super nice, he's still not all that nice. The only reason he's nice to Liam is because Liam is his heir. His uncle has showed him some of the other pieces in his art collection, and eventually he tells Liam that he envies him getting to be a part of an actual installation. Liam knows his house came from America. He knows the name of the artist who designed the installation. So that's enough to go online and find out what's going on, which is that, sure enough, the original house, the one the artist bought and brought over, is a murder house. Some high school kid went berserk in the middle of the night and killed his whole family with a hammer. And this artist, his idea was based on something the robber barons did at the turn of the previous century, which was buy up castles abroad and have them brought over stone by stone to be rebuilt in Texas or upstate Pennsylvania or wherever. And if there was a ghost, they paid even more money. So that was idea number one, to flip that. But then he had idea number two, which was what makes a haunted house. If you take it to pieces and transport it all the way across the Atlantic Ocean, does the ghosts in this case, come with it if you put it back together exactly the way it was? And if you can put a haunted house back together again, piece by piece by piece, can you build your own from scratch if you recreate all of those pieces? And idea number three, forget the ghosts. Can the real live people who go and walk around in one house or the other, or even better, the ones who live in a house without knowing which one is which, would they know which house was real and which one wasn't? Would they see real ghosts in the real house? Imagine they saw ghosts in the fake one. It doesn't matter which house they were living in. I mean, Liam spent time in both houses. He said he never knew which house was real, which house was haunted. The artist was the only one with that piece of information. He even used real blood to recreate the stains. So by the time Liam brought me to see his ancestral home, one of the installation houses had burned down. Liam's mother did it, maybe for religious reasons. Liam was kind of vague about why. I got the feeling it had to do with his teenage years. They went on living there, you see. Liam got older, and I'm guessing his mother caught him fooling around with a girl or smoking pot, something in the house they didn't live in. By this point, she'd become convinced that one of the houses was occupied by unquiet spirits, but she couldn't make up her mind which. And in any case, it didn't do any good. If there were ghosts in the other house, they just moved in next door once it burned down. I mean, why not? Everything was already set up exactly the way they liked it. Liam said there were ghosts. He said he never saw them, but later on, when he lived in other places, he realized that there must have been ghosts in both places, both houses. Other places just felt empty to him. He said to think of it like maybe you grew up in a place where there was always a party going on all the time, or a bar fight, one that went on for years, or maybe just somewhere where the TV was always on. And then you leave the party or you get thrown out of the bar, and all of a sudden you realize you're all alone. Like, you just can't sleep as well without that TV on. You can't get to sleep. He said he was always on high alert when he was away from the murder house because something was missing and he couldn't figure out what. I think that's what I picked up on, that extra vibration, that twitchy radar. So that relationship was over real quick. That's my ghost story. So he brought a picnic dinner with us, lobster, champagne, the works. We sat and ate at the kitchen table while he told me about his childhood. Then he gave me the tour, showed me all the stains where those people died, like they were holy relics. I kept looking out the window and seeing the sun get lower and lower. I didn't want to be in that house after it got dark. I went outside to think and have a cigarette. Yeah, I know, bad astronaut, but I still wanted to sleep with this guy just once. So he was messed up, so what? Sometimes messed up sex is the best. When I came back inside the house, I still hadn't made up my mind. And then I made up my mind in a hurry because this guy, I went to look for him, and he was down on the floor in that little boy's bedroom under the window, okay? On top of that stain, he was rolling around on the floor. You know the way cats do? He had this look on his face, like when they get catnip. I got out of there in a hurry, drove away in his Land Rover. The keys were still in the ignition, left it at a transport cafe, and hitched the rest of the way home and never saw him again. And that's one of the ghost stories. Thank you. I don't actually do introductions much, and so I hope I do a good enough job. Karen deserves a really great introduction. And I think that I ought to begin by quoting some other people who are much better at this than I am. And these are quotes that I think will give you an idea of both the high regard that Karen and her work are held in, and also of the kind of things that she does. So this is Michael Chabon saying, no contemporary writer creates characters more appealing or examines them with greater acuity and forgiveness than she does. And I also really loved what Alice Sebold said about the Jane Austen Book Club, which is, if I could eat this book, I would. And I think between those, that tells you something. And because this reviewer said it much better talking about than I can, a reviewer in the New York Times talking about Sarah Canary said, this book creates that feeling of radiant strangeness. Fowler's willingness to take detours, her unapologetic delight in the odd historical fact, her shadowy humor and the elegant unruliness of her language all elevate her story from the picaresque to the grand. And I had first read Karen's work and then was fortunate enough to take a workshop at Clarion, which was wonderful in many ways. I think that there are writers that you learn things from by reading the work on the page, and I think there are writers who are also extraordinary teachers. And Karen is you know, both of those writers, and I really envy you still, even though I've taken classes with Karen and have been in workshops with her, I still envy people when they get to take a class with her that I don't get to participate in. So I also know that you learn a lot from hearing a writer read their work aloud, and Karen is a wonderful reader.
And I realized that I forgot to say happy anniversary to my husband, because it is actually our anniversary today, which also means that maybe, I guess, 11 years ago now that we did a reading together in Asheville, North Carolina. We did the reading there as part of a party right before we got married. So I guess it's not just a wedding anniversary, but that may be the last time that we read together. I was trying to think. So happy anniversary, which I have failed to say to Gavin. clearly, apparently. So if you see him, apologize to him on my behalf that I've failed to do that. And Karen has a new book, which is forthcoming, and she is going to read to you from that, and I'm not going to say much about it, because I'm not quite sure what she's going to reveal about it. There's a book with many mysteries in it.
It was a wonderful introduction. I can't think what could have been said that I would have wanted said that you did not say. And you refrained from saying some things that I would not have wanted said, which I also appreciate. Because my workshop focused on openings, I am going to read you the opening of my new novel, my forthcoming novel. There is, I was just telling Kelly that they're having many marketing discussions about it, because the thing that I think might make you want to buy the novel is actually supposed to be a surprise that you discover on about page 138. So apparently I've set quite the problem for the marketing department. But they have just sent me the cover and clearly decided to put it on the cover. So I don't know if there's any point in not revealing it now or not. But it is not going to be revealed in the pages that I read to you. The only other thing I would like to say about the pages is that there's a fair amount of swearing in them, and I do apologize for that. This would be of no moment in California. No one would think twice about it, but I did a reading in Hickory, North Carolina, and apparently it was more of an issue there than I realized it was going to be. So I never know. The character is sort of a college-age student, and in the section that I'm going to read, she's a grown woman telling her story, but starting there. And when my kids went to college, although I myself had been very genteel with my language around the house, they came home swearing like sailors. And they now have children of their own, small children, so they've really cleaned it up. But I am the one now who inadvertently says something that makes everybody go, "Grandma!" As those of you who have children know, your children are just a terrible, terrible influence on you. I did nothing of the sort before they brought it into the house. So there's a lot of that here, and I do apologize. It starts with a prologue, which we were talking a lot about in my workshop. The book is called "We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves." Those who know me now will be surprised to learn that I was a great talker as a child. We have a home movie taken when I was 2 years old, the old-fashioned kind with no soundtrack, and by now the colors have bled out, a white sky, my red sneakers a ghostly pink, but you can still see how much I used to talk. I'm doing a bit of landscaping, picking up one stone at a time from our gravel driveway, carrying it to a large tin wash tub, dropping it in, and going back for the next. I'm working hard, but showily. I widen my eyes like a silent film star. I hold up a clear piece of quartz to be admired, put it in my mouth, stuff it into one cheek. My mother appears and removes it. She steps back then out of the frame, but I'm speaking emphatically now. You can see this in my gestures. And she returns, drops the stone into the tub. The whole thing lasts about 5 minutes, and I never stop talking. A few years later, Mom read us that old fairy tale in which one sister, the older, speaks in toads and snakes, and the other, the younger, in flowers and jewels. And this is the image it conjured for me, this scene from this movie where my mother puts her hand into my mouth and pulls out a diamond. I was tow-headed back then, prettier as a child than I've turned out, and dolled up for the camera. My flyaway bangs are pasted down with water and held on one side by a rhinestone barrette shaped like a bow. Whenever I turn my head, the barrette blinks in the sunlight. My little hand sweeps over my tub of rocks. All this I could be saying, all this will be yours someday. Or something else entirely. The point of the movie isn't the words themselves. What my parents valued was their extravagant abundance, their inexhaustible flow. Still, there were occasions on which I had to be stopped. When you think of two things to say, pick your favorite and only say that, my mother suggested once, as a tip to polite social behavior. And the rule was later modified to 1 in 3. My father would come to my bedroom each night to wish me happy dreams, and I would speak without taking a breath, trying desperately to keep him in my room with only my voice. I would see his hand on the doorknob, the door beginning to swing shut. "I have something to say," I'd tell him, and the door would stop midway. "Start in the middle, then," he'd answer. A shadow, with the hall light behind him and tired in the evenings, the way grown-ups are. The light would reflect on my bedroom window like a star you could wish on. Skip the beginning. Start in the middle. Chapter 1 starts with a quote from Franz Kafka, which is, "The storm which blew me out of my past eased off." So the middle of my story comes in the winter of 1996. By then, we'd long since dwindled to the family that old home movie foreshadowed. Me, my mother, and unseen but evident behind the camera, my father. In 1996, 10 years had passed since I'd last seen my brother, 17 since my sister disappeared. The middle of my story is all about their absence, though if I hadn't told you that, you might not have known. By 1996, whole days went by in which I hardly thought of either one. 1996, leap year, year of the fire rat. President Clinton had just been reelected. It would all end in tears. Kabul had fallen to the Taliban. The siege of Sarajevo had ended. Charles had recently divorced Diana. Hale-bopp came swinging into our sky. Claims of a Saturn-like object in the comet's wake first surfaced that November. Dolly the cloned sheep and Deep Blue the chess-playing computer program were superstars. There was evidence of life on Mars. The Saturn-like object in Hale-bopp's tail was maybe an alien spaceship. In May of 1997, 39 people would kill themselves as a prerequisite to climbing aboard. Against this backdrop, how ordinary I look. In 1996, I was 22 years old, meandering through my fourth year at the University of California, Davis, and still maybe only a junior or maybe a senior, but so thoroughly uninterested in the niceties of units or requirements or degrees that I wouldn't be graduating anytime soon. My education, my father liked to point out, was wider than it was deep. He said this often. I saw no reason to hurry. I had no particular ambitions beyond being either widely admired or stealthily influential. I was torn between the two. It hardly mattered, as no major seemed to lead reliably to either. My parents, who were still paying my expenses, found me aggravating. My mother was often aggravated those days. It was something new for her, analeptic doses of righteous aggravation. She was rejuvenated by it. She'd recently announced that she was through being translator and go-between for me and my father. He and I had hardly spoken since. I don't remember minding. My father was a college professor himself and a pedant to the bone. Every exchange contained a lesson, like the pit in a cherry. To this day, the Socratic method makes me want to bite someone. Autumn came suddenly that year like a door opening. One morning, I was bicycling to class when a large flock of Canada geese passed overhead. I couldn't see them or much of anything else, but I heard the jazzy honking above me. There was a tule fog off the fields, and I was wrapped inside it, pedaling through clouds. Thule fogs are not like other fogs, not spotty or drifting, but fixed and substantial. Probably anyone would have felt the risk of moving quickly through an unseen world, but I have, or had as a child, a particular penchant for slapstick and mishap, so I took the full thrill from it. I felt polished by the wet air, and maybe just a little migratory myself, just a little wild. This meant I might flirt a bit in the library if I sat next to anyone flirtable, or I might daydream in class. I often felt wild back then. I enjoyed the feeling, but nothing had ever come of it. At lunchtime, I grabbed something, probably grilled cheese. Let's say it was grilled cheese in the school cafeteria. I was in the habit of leaving my books on the chair next to me where they could be quickly moved if someone interesting came by but would discourage the uninteresting. At 22, I had the callowest possible definition of interesting, and by the measure of my own calipers was far from interesting myself. A couple was sitting at a table near me, and the girl's voice gradually rose to the point where I was forced to pay attention. "You want some fucking space," she said. She was wearing a short blue t-shirt and a necklace with a glass pendant of an angelfish. Long dark hair fell in a messy braid down her back. She stood and cleared the table with one motion of her arm. She had beautiful biceps. I remember wishing I had arms like hers. Dishes fell to the floor and shattered. Ketchup and cola spilled and mixed in the breakage. There must have been music in the background, because there's always music in the background now, our whole lives soundtracked, and most of it too ironic to be random, I'm just saying. But honestly, I don't remember. Maybe there was only sweet silence and the spit of grease on the grill. "How's that?" the girl asked. "Don't tell me to be quiet. I'm just making more space for you." She pushed the table itself over, swung it to one side, dropped it. "Better?" she raised her voice. "Can everyone please leave the room so my boyfriend has more space? He needs a fucking lot of space." She slammed her chair down onto the pile of ketchup and dishes. More sounds of breakage and a sudden waft of coffee. The rest of us were frozen. Forks halfway to our mouths, spoons dipped in our soups, the way people were found after the eruption of Vesuvius. "Don't do this, baby," her boyfriend said once, but she was doing it, and he didn't bother to repeat himself. She moved to another table, empty except for a tray with dirty dishes. There she methodically broke everything that could be broken, threw everything that could be thrown. A salt shaker spun across the floor to my foot. A young man rose from his seat, telling her with a slight stutter to take a chill pill. She threw a spoon that bounced audibly off his forehead. "Don't side with assholes," she said. Her voice was very not chill. He sank back, eyes wide. "I'm okay," he assured the room at large, but he sounded unconvinced. And then surprised. "Holy shit, I've been assaulted." "This is just the shit I can't take," the boyfriend said. He was a big guy with a thin face, loose jeans, and a long coat, nose like a knife. "You go ahead and tear it up, you psycho bitch. Just give me back the key to my place first." She swung another chair, missing my head by maybe 4 feet. I'm being charitable, it seemed like a lot less. Striking my table and upsetting it, I grabbed my glass and plate. My books hit the floor with a loud slap. "Come and get it," she told him. It struck me funny, a cook's invitation over a pile of broken dishes, and I laughed once, convulsively, a strange duck-like hoot that made everyone turn. And then I stopped laughing, because it was no laughing matter, and everyone turned back. Through the glass walls, I could see some people on the quad who'd noticed the commotion and were watching. A threesome on their way in for lunch stopped short at the door. "Don't think I won't." He took a few steps in her direction. She scooped up a handful of ketchup-stained sugar cubes and threw them. "I'm finished," he said. "We're finished. I'm putting your shit in the hallway, and I'm changing the locks." He turned and threw a glass that bounced off his ear. He turned and she threw a glass that bounced off his ear. He missed a step, staggered, touched the spot with one hand, checked his fingers for blood. "You owe me for gas," he said without looking back. "Mail it." And he was gone. There was a moment's pause as the door closed. Then the girl turned to the rest of us. "What are you losers looking at?" She picked up one of the chairs, and I couldn't tell if she was going to put it back or throw it. I think she hadn't completely decided. A campus policeman arrived. He approached me cautiously, hand on his holster. Me, standing above my toppled table and chair, still holding my harmless glass of milk and my plate with a harmless half-eaten grilled cheese sandwich. "Just put it down, honey," he said, "and sit for a minute." Put it down where? Sit where? Nothing in the vicinity was upright but me. "We can talk about this. You can tell me what's going on. You're not in any trouble yet." "Not her," the woman behind the counter told him. She was a large woman and old, 40 or more, with a beauty mark on her upper lip and eyeliner collecting in the corners of her eyes. "You all act like you own the place," she'd said to me once on another occasion when I sent back a burger for more cooking. "But you just come and go. You don't even think how I'm the one who stays." "The tall one," she told the cop. She pointed, but he was paying no attention, so intent on me and whatever my next move would be. "Calm down," he said again, soft and friendly. "You're not in any trouble yet." He stepped forward, passing right by the girl with the braid, holding the chair. I saw her eyes behind his shoulder. "Never a policeman when you need one," she said to me. She smiled, and it was a nice smile, big white teeth. "No rest for the wicked." She hoisted the chair over her head. "No soup for you." She launched it away from me and the cop toward the door. It landed on its back. When the policeman turned to look, I dropped my plate and my fork. I honestly didn't mean to. The fingers of my left hand just unclenched all of a sudden. The noise spun the cop back to me. I was still holding my glass half full of milk. I raised it a little as if proposing a toast. "I'm not playing around here. Don't you fucking test me." And I threw the glass onto the floor. It broke and splashed milk over one of my shoes and up into my sock. I didn't just let it go. I threw that glass down as hard as I could. 2. 40 minutes later, the psycho bitch and I were tucked like ticks into the back of a Yolo County police car, the matter now being way too big for the guileless campus cops. I wrote this before the UC Davis became famous for the pepper spray. My feelings about the guileless Davis campus cops have sadly changed. But back then, I believed in their innocence. Handcuffed, too, which hurt my wrists a great deal more than I'd ever imagined it would. Being arrested had seriously improved the woman's mood. "I told him I wasn't fucking around," she said, which was almost exactly what the campus cop had also said to me, only more in sorrow than in triumph. "So glad you decided to come with. I'm Harlow Fielding, drama department." "No shit." "I never met a Harlow before," I said. "I met a first name Harlow. I'd met a last name Harlow. Named after my mother, who was named after Jean Harlow, because Jean Harlow had beauty and brains, not because Gramps was a dirty old man, not even. But what good did beauty and brains do for her? I ask you, like she's this great role model?" I knew nothing about Jean Harlow except that she was maybe in Gone with the Wind, which I'd never seen nor ever wanted to see. That war is over. Get over it. "I'm Rosemary Cook." "Rosemary for Remembrance," Harlow said. "Awesome. Totally, totally charmed." She slid her arms under her butt and then under her legs so her cuffed wrists ended up twisted in front of her. If I'd been able to do the same, we could have shaken hands, as seemed to be her intention, but I couldn't. We were then taken to the county jail, where this same maneuver created a sensation. A number of policemen were called to watch as Harlow obligingly squatted and stepped over her cuffed hands and back again several times. She deflected their enthusiasm with a winning modesty. "I have very long arms," she said. "I can never find sleeves that fit." Our arresting officer's name was Arnie Haddock. When Arnie Haddock took off his hat, his hair was receding from his forehead in a nice, clean, round curve that left his features nicely uncluttered like a happy face. He removed our cuffs and turned us over to the county for processing. "As if we were cheese," Harlow noted. She gave every indication of being an old pro at this. I was not. The wildness I'd felt that morning had long since vanished and left something squeezed into its place, something like grief or maybe homesickness. What had I done? Why in the world had I done it? Fluorescent lights buzzed like flies above us, picking up the shadows under everyone's eyes, turning us all old, desperate, and a little green. "Excuse me, how long will this take?" I asked. I was polite as could be. It occurred to me that I was going to miss my afternoon class. European medieval history, Iron Maidens and oubliettes and burned at the stake. It takes as long as it takes, the woman from the county gave me a nasty green look. Be faster if you don't irritate me with questions. Too late for that. In the next breath, she sent me to a cell so I'd be out of her hair while she did the paperwork on Harlow. Don't worry, boss, Harlow told me. I'll be right along. Boss, the woman from the county repeated. Harlow shrugged. Boss, leader, mastermind. She gave me that flaming Zamboni smile. El Capitan. The day may come when policemen and college students aren't natural enemies, but I sure don't expect to live to see it. I was made to remove my watch, shoes, and belt and taken barefoot into a cage with bars and a sticky floor. The woman who collected my things was as mean as she could be. There was an odor in the air, a strong amalgamation of beer, cafeteria lasagna, bug spray, and piss. The bars went all the way to the top of the cell. I checked to be sure. I'm a pretty good climber for a girl. More fluorescence in the ceiling, louder buzzing, and one of the lights was blinking, so the scene in the cell dimmed and brightened as if whole days were rapidly passing. It would have been nice to be wearing shoes. Two women were already in residence. One sat on the single naked mattress. She was young and fragile, black and drunk. I need a doctor, she said to me. She held out her elbow. Blood was slowly oozing from a narrow gash, its color changing from red to purple in the blinking light. She screamed so suddenly I flinched. I need help here. Why won't anyone help me? No one, myself included, responded, and she didn't speak again. The other woman was middle-aged, white, nervous, and thin as a needle. She had stiff bleached hair and a salmon-colored suit that was dressy considering the occasion. She just rear-ended a cop car, she said, and only the week before she'd been arrested for shoplifting tortillas and salsa for a Sunday afternoon football party at her house. This is so not good, she told me. Honestly, I have the worst luck. Eventually, I was processed. I can't tell you how many hours had passed as I had no watch, but it was considerably after I had given up all hope. Harlow was still in the office, shifting about on a rocky chair, making the leg thump while she fine-tuned her statement. She'd been charged with destruction of property and creating a public nuisance. They were garbage charges, she told me. They didn't concern her, they shouldn't concern me. She made a phone call to her boyfriend, the guy from the cafeteria. He drove right over, and she was gone before they finished my paperwork. I think I will stop there. Thank you.
This has been a presentation of the Kentucky Women Writers Conference and the University of Kentucky. We would like to thank LexArts, the Kentucky Foundation for Women, and the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning for supporting these endeavors. For more information, please visit KentuckyWomenWriters.org.